Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Welcome to the K-12 Leaders Education Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder. I'm your host, Susie Brooks, and I'm joined with my co-host, Michael Bronder. We're thrilled to have you with us this morning as we dive into the top education headlines from across the web. Whether you're an educator, administrator, or just passionate about K-12 education, this show is for you. What's on the agenda today? Well, we have four top stories that we're going to be diving into. One of them is why parents should stop texting their kids at school, and that's coming at us from district administration out of AP News. And also we have why all Maine students now get free school lunches, and what does that mean for poverty data? That one also is coming out of district administration and also the Portland Press Herald. We have another story that is entitled, Is the National Guard a Solution for School Violence? And that one is written by F. Chris Curran and coming out of The Conversation. And another one is, With Help, Indie Families Bring Home Books That Kids Will Want to Read. The source on that one is The 74 and also The Mirror Indie by Carly Lanchick. And Mike, do you have anything that you'd like to roll us out to start with today?
Good morning, Susie.
Good morning.
Great to see you after a late night with the Oscars. Let's see. Today we have, kicking us off from eSchool News and Laura Assioni. I need to check in with her and make sure I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Mm-hmm. Five things you need to know about the science of reading. While high-quality literacy instruction has remained a cornerstone of education leaders' priorities this year, the science of reading has dominated classrooms and discussions around instructional strategies. You can find more of that great article on eSchool News. We link to it on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And then we also have a story of the journey to digital sustainability, a CIO's perspective, and that is by Maurice Dragon, who tells a story of a meeting with education technology and instructional leaders and how that affirms multifaceted and critical digital sustainability for schools. An important topic as we're facing so much budget pressure. You can find that link on k12leaders.com/breakdown, and that will bring you to the eSchool News story. And then from the New York Times Learning Network, another great discussion for students on the topic of what's the best and worst part of being a sports fan. We love the Learning Network here, and they provide a bunch of great discussion prompts and details to bring into your classroom, and we'd suggest you take a look at them on k12leaders.com/thebreakdown. Now going in depth, we've had several headlines about school violence here in Brockton, Massachusetts. And this summary of an article by Chris Curran, who's an associate professor of educational leadership and policy at the University of Florida, was first brought to us by the 74. And we are doing a readout here on K-12 Leaders from time to time. I'm sorry, this is not from the 74. This is from The Conversation. And you can find the link to the full article on k12leaders.com/breakdown. From time to time, elected officials facing increased violence or unrest suggest calling in the National Guard for assistance. Recently, officials in Brockton, Massachusetts took the unusual step of requesting the National Guard be deployed to Brockton High School to help address student fights, drug use, and disrespect towards staff. As a researcher who studies school discipline weighs in, the situation is part of a broader national trend of schools struggling with perceived increases in student misbehavior since the COVID-19 pandemic. While the National Guard has been utilized in educational settings before, the history is mixed. In 1957, the Arkansas National Guard initially blocked 9 Black students from integrating into an all-white high school in Little Rock, before eventually being ordered to enforce desegregation weeks later. More tragically, in 1970, the Ohio National Guard fatally shot 4 students during protests at Kent State University over the Vietnam War. More positively, during the pandemic, the New Mexico National Guard helped fill teaching vacancies, receiving generally favorable reviews. And after the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting, there were proposals to fund using the Guard for school security, though it did not pass. School officials in Brockton argue the Guard could provide much-needed staffing support to address behavior issues. However, the researcher raises concerns that a military presence, even temporary, may escalate situations or make students feel less welcome. Research shows effective teaching, positive school environments, and relationships are a key for safe schools. The increasing militarization of schools, from grenade launchers for school police to data linking officers to higher suspension and arrest rates, underscores these worries over a National Guard deployment. Ultimately, the research believes calling the National Guard is treating a symptom, not the root cause of misbehavior. What schools truly need are more teachers, counselors, and mentors to build supportive educative environments for students. With the Massachusetts governor rejecting the National Guard request, the Brockton High situation highlights the challenges facing many schools post-pandemic. But as critics like the NAACP argue, a military response is unlikely the solution the students deserve. You can read more about that on The Conversation by and that the researcher that we're citing is Chris Curran, F. Chris Curran from the University of Florida. And we'd encourage you to find that link on k12leaders.com/breakdown. Ms. Brooks.
That's a good one to share, Michael. And yeah, we've been hearing that one on the news locally. This morning, I believe I have a few to read out as well. Nick Benedict's death in Oklahoma prompts federal investigation and what happens now. There are several news sources that are reporting on the U.S. Department on Education and the FBI picking up on the investigation of Nick Benedict's death after a fight in an Oklahoma school bathroom. And so you can pick up more on that on our headlines. And then also, we have how teachers can be even better allies during mental health crises. And the source on that is District Administration by Matt Zalesnik. And student leaders were asked, what is one thing that you want your teachers to know about your personal experience in school, online, and with peers? The post is on how teachers can be even better allies during mental health crises, which appeared first in District Administration. And so, one that I think, Mr. Bronder, I just stole two of your headlines now that I'm realizing it.
There is no stealing, Susie. We're just out of order. It's fine.
How did that sound? I won't steal your story, though.
I think you were going to, your next story was going to be about parents not texting their kids in school.
It was, absolutely. We need to color code things. I think that would probably help. All right, so let's go on to that, shall we? Oh, I'm cracking myself up over here. And they should stop texting their kids at school, but that's just my own opinion. So this story is coming at us from District Administration. It's out of the AP News, March 11th. Virginia High School teacher Joe Clement keeps track of the text messages that parents have sent students by sitting in his economics and government classes. And these are all direct quotes. Hey, what did you get on your test? Did you get the field trip form signed? Do you want chicken or hamburgers for dinner tonight? Clement has a plea for parents: stop texting your kids at school. Parents are distressingly aware of the distractions and the mental health issues associated with smartphones and social media, but teachers say that parents might not realize how much of these struggles play out at school. And so this. You can actually go straight to the AP News site and be able to read more on it. But it goes on to say that one culprit, mom and dad themselves, whose stream of consciousness questions add to a climate of constant interruption and distraction from learning. Even when schools regulate or ban cell phones, it's hard for teachers to enforce it. And the constant buzzes or watches and phones are occupying critical brain space regardless of whether or not kids are sneaking a peek. A few changes in parents' behavior can make phones less distracting at school, and here's what teachers and experts recommend. They want you to try it. Just stop texting your kids at school. Many parents stay in touch with their kid with their child by texting, but school is a place for focusing on learning and developing independence. Teachers say that you can still reach out to your child if you have a change in plans or family emergency. Just contact the front office. If the message is not urgent, it can probably wait. Think of it this way. If you came to school and said, "Can you pull my child out of calculus so I can tell them something not important?" we would say no, Central Virginia School Counselor Erin Rettig said. Teachers emphasize they are not saying parents are to blame for school cell phone battles, just that parents can do more to help. Tell your kids, for example, not to text home unless it's urgent, and if they do, ignore it. When your children are texting you stuff that can wait, like, "Can I go to Brett's house for 5 days from now?" then don't respond, said Sabine Pollock, one of three mothers who co-founded the Phone Free Schools movement. You have to stop engaging. That's just feeding the problem. Cut the cord from 8 to 3. Many parents got used to being in constant contact during the COVID-19 pandemic when kids were home during online school. They have kept that communication going as life has otherwise returned to normal. We call it the digital umbilical cord. Parents can't let go, and they need to, Clement said. Parents might not expect their kids to respond immediately to texts, though many do. But when students pull out their phones to reply, it often opens the door to other social media distractions. Anxiety via text message. At parent workshops, Rettig, the school counselor in Virginia, tells parents that they are contributing to children's anxiety by sending messages, tracking their whereabouts, and checking grades daily, which doesn't give kids space to be independent at school. Some teachers say that they get emails from parents right after returning graded exams, before class is over, because kids feel the need or are told to report grades immediately to parents. Dr. Libby Milkovich, a developmental and behavioral pediatrician at Children's Mercy Kansas City, says she asks parents to consider what kids miss out on by having parents at arm's reach during school hours. By texting back and forth with a parent, a child is unable to practice either self-calming or problem-solving skills, Milkovich said. It's easy to text, but if I don't have a phone, I have to ask the teacher or I have to figure it out on my own. Some kids who oppose school cell phone bans says it's helpful to reach out to parents when they're feeling anxious or worried at school. For children with serious anxiety who are accustomed to texting parents for reassurance, Milkovich suggests phasing in limits so the child can gradually practice having more independence. She urges parents to ask themselves, "Why does my child need constant access to a phone?" Often parents say, "I want to be able to reach my child at any time," which has nothing to do with the child's outcome. It's because of the parents' anxiety, she says. Take away that old phone. Beth Black, a high school English teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area, tells parents to consider confiscating their child's old phones. Her school requires students to put phones in a special cell phone holder when they enter classrooms, but she has seen students stash their old inactive phone there and hold on to their phone that works. Like many teachers, she said that phones aren't the only problem. There's also earbud issues. 40% of my students have at least one earbud in when they walk into class, she said. The kids will set their phone into the holder to music, and then they'll listen to music in class in one earbud. Also, turn off notifications. Parents reining in their texts will only go so far, so work with your kids to turn off some of or all of their attention-stealing notifications. To prove just how distracting smartphones are, Clement ran an in-class experiment where he asked students to take their phones off silent and switch on notifications for 2 minutes. It sounded like an all-time video arcade, bizzing, buzzing, dinging, and ringing for solid 2 minutes, he said. Many students have found students check their phones frequently during class. A study last year from Common Sense Media found teens get bombarded with as many as 237 notifications a day. About 25% of them pop up during the school day, mostly from friends on social media. Every time our focus is interrupted, it takes a lot of brain power and energy to get back on task, said Emily Churkin, a Seattle-based teacher turned consultant who specializes in screen time management. Teachers say the best school cell phone policy is one that physically removes the phone from the child, otherwise, it's hard to compete. When the phone vibrates in their pocket, now their focus is on the pocket, and they're wondering, how do I get this out on the table? How do I check it? Said Randy Freeman, a high school chemistry teacher in upstate New York. You can ask them a question and they haven't heard a word you've said. Their brain is elsewhere. Another very relevant article, and I'm sure it resonates with people from all areas of the country who work with students who have cell phones. Sorry about stealing those two articles from you, Michael. I'm sure that you can steal two back from me if you want.
No, that's a great article, Susan. Thanks for sharing that. And
You're welcome.
we see a lot of solutions for like phone bags, and they have both like disciplinary and instructional uses. And there have been stories over the last couple of weeks that we've touched on around schools banning cell phones as well. So that goes into some good depth, and I appreciate you reading that out. Thanks.
You're welcome.
A couple of other stories here. Really neat story out of Philadelphia. And this is reported by Jim Fields from the 74. And Gavriella Beatrice Kalischer knew that from an early age that STEM was for her. But it was in high school that she knew she wanted to specialize in neuroscience. I think because we know so little about the brain, she said. And what that has led her to do is to create an experiment where she's given fruit flies anxiety to understand what makes us anxious. You can read more about that really fun story in Gabrielle Beatrice Kalischer on the 74, and you can search for Jim Fields and or come to visit us at k12leaders.com/breakdown. And we have the link for you on that page. Another story today from USA Today that breaks down how schools are hiring more teachers than ever, but we still have a teacher shortage. And it goes into some detail about teacher pay scales and those effects on teacher retention. And we will, let's see, we're going to take another dive into a feel-good story from Indianapolis. This reported originally from Mirror Indy and can also be found on the 74.org. With help, Indy families bring home books kids want to read. For many families, building a home library can be a challenge, especially when kids have different reading interests and abilities. But one Indianapolis mom named Jessica Davis has found a creative way to cultivate her children's love of reading through a grant program. Davis has three kids, a bookworm daughter who devours multiple books at once, a son who avoids reading, and another son with autism who needs some extra stimulation. To engage each of them, Davis has filled her home with all kinds of books, chapter books, picture books, fantasy novels, sports biographies, and stories featuring successful Black heroes. But purchasing over 200 books for a home library is no small expense. That's where the Mind Trust, a local nonprofit, came in. Over the past 4 years, the organization has provided small literacy grants from $500 to $5,000 to dozens of families in Indianapolis. Davis received two rounds of funding totaling $4,500. She used that money to build out a cozy reading nook with bean bags, rugs, and shelves, creating an inviting space to spend time with the books. She carefully selected titles to reflect her family's cultural backgrounds and interests. The grants have allowed Davis to accelerate her home literacy efforts in a way that would have taken years to accomplish on her own limited budget, and it's paying off. Davis says all of her kids' reading scores have improved significantly. Kateri Whitley from the Mind Trust emphasizes that the Go Farther Literacy Fund isn't just about skill building. It's building community, she says, by giving families resources to cultivate reading as a shared experience. For Jessica Davis, that means opening up her home library to neighborhood kids without access to many books. Her hope is to continually refresh her collection through future grant cycles, creating an oasis for children to discover the joy of reading. As states like Indiana work to improve stagnant literacy rates through tutoring programs and policy changes, grassroots efforts like these home libraries provide another innovative model to help kids hooked, get kids hooked on books. And you can find that story, the original story, on Mirror Indy and the74.org. We have links to both of those on k12leaders.com/breakdown. Ms.
Awesome.
Brooks.
Awesome. I have a few myself. One of them is coming out of Texas, where a superintendent was suspended amid some investigation into casting the Broadway show Oklahoma. And that one is coming from district administration. Sherman ISD Superintendent Tyson Bennett was suspended without, well, with pay, excuse me, a decision that comes amid a third-party investigation into how a transgender student was removed from his role in the high school production of Oklahoma. And then also a story coming from Tech and Learning on creating a comprehensive cybersecurity plan for schools, where the administration there shares the strategies that have made Elton ISD a district-wide cybersecurity plan so successful. And that brings me to a story on how I am in the right spot, how all Maine students now get free school lunches, and what does that mean for poverty data? And this is another one coming out of district administration through the Portland Press Herald. So let me grab that story so I can share that with you. And if you'd like to see it directly, you can head to K12leaders/breakdown, and you'll be able to see that yourself. Where did I put it?
This is where the shuffling
Oops.
of papers comes in,
It
Susie.
is, yeah. There you go. Instead, you hear the clicking of the trackpad. All right. So all Maine students now get free school lunches. And what does that mean for poverty data? Maine was one of the first states to pass legislation providing free school lunches to all students after pandemic-era funding expired, a policy that has been adopted in seven other states and is being considered across the country. But since the law took effect a year and a half ago, some districts have struggled with an unintended consequence. Now that parents no longer need to fill out applications to get their children access to free meals, officials have lost an important source of data on their district's low-income households. Information traditionally used for funding. The free and reduced price meal application, a federal form sent home with students at the start of the school year, allows districts to determine what percentage of students qualify for free or reduced price meals. And so this story continues through the Portland Herald, the Portland Press Herald. Sorry, I want to make sure I get that done correctly. The free and reduced price meal application, a federal form sent home with students at the start of the year, allows districts to determine what percentage of students qualify for free or reduced price meals. That information has traditionally been used to allocate funding to districts and schools and to identify whether students or teachers are eligible for certain grants or waivers. But now that meals are free for all students, fewer parents are filling out the forms. In RSU 71 in Belfast, for instance, the district received just two forms last year. Oh boy, this year it has received none. Traditionally, districts have been reimbursed by the state for all meals. The federal government then reimburses the state based on the percentage of those meals that were free or reduced price. If parents don't fill out the forms, their children are considered able to pay for full price meals, and the state gets smaller payouts. Today, the state is still reimbursing districts for each meal that they provide, but the question is how much the state is getting from the federal government, said Justin Strausberger, executive director of Full Plates, Full Potential, a group that advocates for child nutrition. They should be getting the full amount for every student who qualifies, but we know that that's an underreported, and so that means that the state has been on the hook for a larger percentage of that reimbursement than it should be, he said. His organization has tried to spread awareness about the usefulness of these forms, even as meals are free for all students. We've worked really hard to lead outreach campaigns to get people to fill out the application, he said, but it is one more loop that we're asking people in poverty to jump through. David Knight, an associate professor of education finance and policy at the University of Washington College of Education, said free and reduced price meal data has always been a flawed metric for measuring student poverty because it is a binary indicator of whether you're eligible or not eligible. Many who study education policy have wanted to move away from it for a long time, Knight said. Schools need a way to measure poverty. And this school year, the Maine Department of Education stopped using free and reduced price meal data to allocate Title I funding to low-income districts. Title I funding is federal money meant to supplement state and local education budgets with the goal of helping low-income students who have consistently been shown to have worse educational outcomes than their wealthier peers succeed in school. And more than half of Maine's districts have adopted school nutrition programs that don't rely on these forms. Despite the administrative challenges and questions about funding, experts and school officials say that move to universal free lunch has been unequivocally positive development for students. In RSU 71, the director of school nutrition, Pearlie Martin, said the district is actually getting reimbursed more than before as a greater number of students are eating breakfast and lunch at school. Last year, the number of students eating breakfast was up by 19% and lunch by 9%. So I'm not really seeing the impact of parents not filling out the form as far as the food service program, Martin said. But he said, the district's Title I funding has been affected. The superintendent did not respond to questions about exactly how Title I funding has been impacted. According to state data, 38% of RSU 71 students qualified for free and reduced price meals in the 22-23 school year, compared to almost 56% in 2018. This shift does not correspond to a drastic change in poverty levels, but is simply due to missing information, Martin said. The best idea for the state, Martin said, might be to find another way to collect data on economically disadvantaged students. I don't believe in free and reduced lunch applications are going to come back, he said. This is something the Maine Department of Education has acknowledged. We've been hearing loud and clear from important stakeholders about the unintentional negative impact of the incredibly positive move to universal free lunch for all students, said Cheryl Lang of the ESEA Federal Program Director at the Maine Department of Education in a video update last year. This is a much needed move for the consequence. As you know, of the reduction in families turning to those free and reduced lunch forms, which is what Title I has used for alternative data for small districts, districts under 20,000, in reallocating Title I funding more accurately for our state. So the article goes on quite a bit longer, and it's definitely something worth checking out, trying to find that balance between keeping the data so that you can plan for the future, but also continuing to be able to provide for those students who need it most. So I would suggest checking it out on k12leaders.com/breakdown.
Thank you, Susie. What a nuanced and detailed calculus districts have to go through, states have to go through, federal, Department of Education has to go through in terms of making sure that students get the services they need, while we make sure the programs are sustainable and equitable. So thanks for reading that out. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This has been the Education Breakdown on K-12 Leaders. I am Mike Bronder.
I'm Susie Brooks.
And we'll be back tomorrow reading the K-12 news so you don't have to. As always, make good choices and have a great day at school, everyone.